easy to grasp, but how would you explain it?
Yeah, so wet bulb temperature is, at least here in the United States, akin to what we often see as the heat index. They're not exactly a one-to-one relationship, but what the heat index tries to capture is the combined effect of the what we call the dry bulb temperature, just the air temperature that you would feel outside, and the impact from humidity in the air. So we can think of wet bulb like the heat index, or the, you often hear it called, the real feel temperature outside, as trying to capture the combined effect of air temperature and humidity. If you're outside and it's a particularly muggy day, you're going to feel as if the temperature outside is much hotter than maybe just your dry bulb thermometer hanging outside the window might tell you.
And when it comes to heat and humidity, at what point does discomfort turn to possibly fatal danger?
So the threshold we used in our study was 27 degrees centigrade wet bulb. So this is roughly the boundary that the National Weather Service in the United States has identified as the boundary for danger to human health. Beyond this, when we reach 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature, this has been identified in previous work as the theoretical lethal limit of wet bulb temperature.
I interviewed Dr. Daniel J. Vasilio. He's a postdoctoral scientist at Penn State, and his tests on actual humans, he used students, showed that people became uncomfortable and ranging towards sick at a much lower temperature. So I'm glad that you chose the 27-degree wet bulb temperature instead of 35.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually been a few papers that have come out in the past year that have tried to revise the differences between these thresholds in terms of discomfort, danger, and specific impacts to human health. We feel pretty comfortable that our 27 degrees is an appropriate threshold for the work we did here. But of course, there are so many different factors to take into account when we think about all the different activities that people might be doing outside, how acclimated they are to their specific climate, that these thresholds might be more variable than we think for different populations.
Well, most weather watchers are looking for absolute high temperatures, the dry bulb temperature. But as you cited in your report, a 2020 study led by Pinya Wang found extreme high wet bulb temperature is more sensitive to the changing climate than extreme high dry bulb temperature. Hot and humid events are intensified by global warming more than those hot, dry days. Are we looking at the wrong risks?
Yeah, that's right. I think that, you know, shifting our focus towards a measure like wet bulb or heat index puts us in the right direction to better capture the impacts of climate change on the human body here. Like you said, just dry bulb temperature doesn't really capture all of the variability that might really be impacting humans the most.
So how did you work out the risks for agricultural workers as climate change gets worse?
So the premise of our study was to combine three different sources of information. So we have our climate information, and for us, that was the daily maximum wet bulb temperature. So we have our climate information. Then we try and combine this with agricultural information. Because we're looking at the impact of agricultural workers specifically, we wanted to nail down what parts of the year these workers are most likely to be planting or harvesting in the field. So we took crop planting and harvest season dates from the global crop calendar data set, and we tried to line this up with our climate information and our threshold for danger to human health. We looked all around the globe, and we simply asked, if we are in a planting or harvest season for a specific crop, we looked at 12 in this study, if the workers are present in the field, are they exposed to a daily maximum wet bulb temperature greater than this threshold?
And so what crops are most affected when field conditions go beyond human tolerance?
So after looking at our data, what we found was that rice, maize, sorghum, and soybeans were the most impacted crops across the globe, which is notable because rice and maize specifically are two massively cultivated staple crops across the world.
Well, I'll note for our American listeners that maize is basically the same thing as corn, so that's what we're talking about there. Some places will be too hot to work during the day as long as 3 months of the year, you've found. Where are those first intolerable hot spots?
Yeah, so some of the most impacted regions in the world that we found for rice and maize, but also for many of the other crops in our study, are in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Vietnam, parts of China. We also found potentially intolerable conditions in equatorial South America. Coastal Mexico is another region near Baja California that pops up. The Gulf of Guinea in Western Africa also is particularly exposed as well.
So I guess you didn't count places like Dubai or places on the Gulf because they are desert areas anyway. You were looking at big crop growing areas.
That's right. So ultimately, we were restricted in our analysis based on where we have data, where we have all of the data that we need for the analysis. So not only did we have to know that crops were harvested in a specific region, we had to have a fine enough resolution data on the planting and harvest dates for those crops. So those aren't completely available from these agricultural data sets, which, as we note in our paper, is a huge area for improvement. The more data that we can collect on agriculture and agricultural workers, where they're harvesting, what times of day they're harvesting, how many laborers are in the field. This is really important data that we're going to need in the future to be able to better pin down where these hazards are across the world. But places like Dubai do see extreme wet bulb temperatures coming off of the coast there. So while the hazard is there, data and large agricultural data in those countries might just not be available.
So have the amount of days too extreme for outdoor farm work increased since 1979? And is that speeding up as our emissions mount?
Yeah, so across our study period here, it was notable that in the past 20 years specifically, we saw most of the increase in these potential hazardous days to agricultural workers. Not only was the increase apparently nonlinear in these last 20 years, the impact from El Nino events was much larger, especially since the 1997-1998 El Nino events.
That's a little worrying because an El Nino heating just began around September of this year, 2023, and other studies found the worst of El Nino comes in the second or even third year, not right away. Do you expect extra heat stress for agricultural workers coming up in 2024 or 25?
Based on our analysis, I would. The 2016 El Nino was the largest spike in potential hazards to agricultural workers that we found. That was a very big El Nino event. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that we could see another spike like that for our next large El Nino event.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex. Our guest is American researcher Connor Dunn-Diaz. We're talking about heat and humidity going beyond human tolerance and impacts on the global food chain. Connor, surely humans will find answers. They can work at night or retreat to cooling huts periodically. Maybe robots can do the harvesting. Given the scale of what you found, do you really think there are ways to adapt and keep the big global food chain going?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that one of the benefits of our study here is that it provides critical information to policymakers, to people in the agricultural industry, to begin to start thinking about how we can change our agricultural practices to best protect the workers, which really are the backbone of our global food system. Now, previous work has shown that our adaptability, different measures in keeping farm workers cool and healthy during the day might become less effective under these warming scenarios. But personally, I think if we take this information that we have at hand here, we can begin to think through ways of adapting our food system to, again, protect our agricultural workers who are holding up our global food system.
So should governments set and enforce outdoor worker safety limits? And is that practical when millions of people must plant and harvest or starve?
Yes, I think so. I think we have an opportunity here to start implementing some of these limits from the perspective of being able to keep our workers in the field during these critical seasons. I noticed a couple years ago during the Pacific Northwest heat wave, I remember hearing a report about strawberry harvesters harvesting overnight during those really, really brutally hot weeks there. You know, that might seem like an extreme to us now, harvesting throughout the night, but if we begin to establish limits and regulations around when people can be doing work outside, we can keep our agricultural system going.
And studies show that hospital visits go up during these hot, humid heat waves, and even chronic kidney disease in Central America has been attributed to this. So there are real-world consequences for those workers.
That's right. I think we're at a point here where we're beginning to get a critical mass of information linking these brutally hot heat waves to real impacts, not just agricultural workers. All sorts of outdoor workers, construction workers, are also found in the literature around the impacts of heat hazards. These really do have real impacts on people. The kidney disease research that you mentioned was particularly startling to me, in that that seems some of the best evidence we have at the moment that is linking our warming climate to very granular person-to-person impacts.
And the study also highlights climate injustice. The people living in the regions shown in the maps in your paper, hardest hit by the heat and humidity, they're among the poorest. They hardly contributed to climate change, but they suffer most. Your thoughts?
We've cited some of the sociological research that has pointed out that, yes, agricultural workers are often some of the most vulnerable populations across the world. And I think it's really important to keep this in mind when we think about, you know, the next time you go to the grocery store, the next time you sit down to have a meal, you know, there are at-risk populations across the world that are working very hard in hazardous conditions here to make that happen. Moving forward, we really need to keep front and center the human dimension of our food system here in light of the fact that these laborers are so at risk across the world.
Do you think that if these crops fail because people just can't get out there to harvest them or to plant them, that that might stir up more immigration in safer countries to live in?
It seems plausible. I mean, I can't really, you know, that's not really my area of expertise. But I think what you're hitting on here is a great point to make, and it's the fact that we're looking at compound events here. You know, we often think about impacts to the crops themselves under extreme weather events, and now our study is looking at impacts to the human dimension of the agricultural system. There are follow-on impacts as well. Now, you know, what those may be in terms of immigration and different regional impacts to society, I don't know, but it's important to keep in mind that there are interlinking impacts that happen to society because of these climate extremes.
Well, although we don't really know it in the developed world, about 27% of all workers in the world are agricultural workers. So this is really a key safety point that we need to know and something that we can do to protect people. We have been speaking with Connor Dunn-Diaz. Look for his new open access paper, Increased Extreme Humid Heat Hazard Faced by Agricultural Workers. I will put links to follow up in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Connor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a great time being on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Modern life reaches the fatal limits of the planet. Dr. Vanessa Andriotti is lead author of the book Hospicing Modernity. In this radio selection, Vanessa talks about the book and the University of British Columbia report, Moving with Storms.
Starting with a land acknowledgement, I would like to just affirm my responsibility as a settler, as a racialized settler in this place, to support Indigenous peoples to have their lands and lives restored. So I was asked today to talk a little bit about a book that I wrote called Hospice and Modernity and what is relevant of this book. So the book is called Hospice and Modernity, Facing Humanity's Wrongs and the Implications for Social Activism. And the word modernity there, that's the first chapter, is who the heck is modernity? And modernity is a single story. It's presented in the book as a single story of progress, development, and civilization that is expiring. And therefore, hospicing is about giving palliative care to a dying modernity while offering prenatal care to systems that could be in gestation, but that we don't yet know what they look like, and that they could be wiser, but not necessarily. It depends on how we are going to hospice the old in order to be able to welcome the new. So the wisdom of the new system depends on our ability to be taught by the mistakes of the old. Modernity is expiring because its promises of growth and prosperity have encountered the limits of the planet. And the book looks at the impact of modernity on our thinking, the ways we feel and process our feelings, our scope of relationships and relationality, and even our neurobiology. So it talks about how modernity both has given us specific gifts, but it also limits our existence in the planet. And it looks also at how education has contributed to these limitations and how education can actually support us in overcoming these limitations and bringing ourselves together to show up differently to each other and to the planet. In the book, modernity is sustained, the explanation is that modernity is sustained through four denials. So the first is the denial, and these denials are socially sanctioned. The first is the denial of systemic violence and complicity in harm, the fact that our comfort, securities, and enjoyments are subsidized by expropriation and exploitation somewhere else. They happen at the expense of other people, other species, and the land. The second is the denial of the limits of the planet, the fact that the planet cannot sustain exponential growth and consumption indefinitely. The third is the denial of entanglement, our insistence in seeing ourselves as separate from each other and from the land, rather than entangled within a living wider metabolism that is biointelligent, that is the planet. And the fourth is the denial of the magnitude and complexity of the challenges we'll need to face together, the tendency to look for simplistic solutions that make us feel and look good and that may address symptoms, but not the root causes of our collective hyper-complex predicament. So in the book, which is actually the result of the work of a collective called Gesturing Towards the Colonial Futures, we use lots of stories and metaphors to be able to engage people. We're using different parts of the brain with a different neurochemistry of learning. So one of the stories we tell is the story that modernity of the house that modernity built. And in the story, we ask people to observe the different parts of themselves that relate to the story differently so that we can layer ourselves and understand our own complexity in engaging with stories. So this story comes both from the literature, critical literature, but also from the lived experiences of communities where the story was built and workshopped. So I will tell you the story and I will invite you to think about and to observe the parts of yourself that relate differently to the story that I'm going to tell. So the story of the House of Modernity has four different parts. In the first part, we talk about the existence of a house on a planet, and the house is exceeding the limits of the planet. So this house is built on a foundation of separability, the separation between humans and nature. And it's an imposed sense of separation because we're actually not really separated. We're part of everything. But this sense of separation creates several implications for our existence, including the idea that in terms of our life, we need to produce value within the economies of the house to be deserving of being alive. And then other species are also, the value of other species are also measured according to the value they can produce in certain economies within the house. So the intrinsic value of life is one of the things that the separability, the separation between humans and nature, it's one of the things that it erodes. The separability also creates hierarchies between not only between species, but also between cultures and between individuals. So the worth of individuals is always measured within the house according to how they produce and contribute to the economies within the house. This house has also two different carrying walls. The first carrying wall is the carrying wall of the nation state. And we tend to think about the nation state as being created to protect people. But the history of the nation state is actually a history of protecting property and property owners, and the protection of people through the dispensation of rights like human rights, civil rights, or indigenous rights only happens when there's interest convergence between the interests of protecting people and the interests of capital and protecting property. Now, the other carrying wall is the carrying wall of universal reason. And this is the single story that I talked about before, the single story of progress, development, and civilization that creates epistemicides. It kills the possibility of aliveness for other stories, of other understandings of progress, other understandings of success, other understandings of development. And then we have the roof of global capital. It can take different shapes, but the current roof that we have is about speculative, shareholder, algorithmic capitalism. This roof in this story is structurally damaged for different reasons. I'm not going to go into them. In the book, we explain it a little bit more. But this structural damage is related to the irresponsible pursuit of profit for profit's sake. That's the first part of the story. The second part is about the hidden costs of the house. So you have the house, we have unsustainable growth within the house and overconsumption, and two arrows, one extracting and expropriating things from the planet, the other one dumping the waste on the planet. And in the planet, we see destitution, dispossession, genocides, and also ecocide. So this second part of the story about the hidden costs of the house show that the house has been created, it's subsidized, and is maintained by social and ecological violence. Then we have the third part of the story, which is about the floors of the house. And here we played a little bit with the idea of global north and south. But at the north of the north in the house, we have the penthouse, where there is discretionary wealth, basically. And historically and systemically, this wealth is created in the construction of the house. And then we have in the middle, the stairs of social mobility of the north of the south. Then we have the south of the north, in the basement of the house, people who do not have access to social mobility, who may not want access to social mobility, may want to build different communities, but still within the protection of the house. And in the planet, we have the south of the south, those who are fighting for a different kind of existence and who are receiving the sewage of the house in their territory. So here I would put, for example, the struggle of the Hunikui people in the Amazon, who are fighting against carbon trading or the financialization of nature, who are insisting that they are part of the forest, that they are the forest, and they do not want to live in a house. They want to continue to live in the forest, not because they are forced to, but because that is a healthier form of existence. in relationship to this third part of the story, we have the questioning and challenging of the idea of the promise of social mobility, universal middle class for all, that reminds us that if we had the same standards of living of the working class, even of the global north, we would need many more planets. The estimate is 6 planets to live, because the levels of consumption and production that are necessary for this consumption are unsustainable. And there's already an offshoot of the limits of the planet in terms of consuming more than our fair share. Then we have the last frame of the house, talking about the structural damage of the roof and the weight of climate destabilization, biodiversity loss, economic instability, the cancellation of rights that we see in many countries, populist governments being elected because people want to protect their interests within the house, and a lot of precarity. So we have socioeconomic, political, mental health, and ecological crisis within the house. And then we see more violent conflict and mass and forced migration also in the planet. So the question here then, do we fix the house? Do we expand the house? Do we build another house? Do we live without a house? Or do we find another planet? And as we engage with these questions, we have also mapped 3 different streams of perspective. So some people will advocate for soft reform of the house with more modernity as the answer to the problems of modernity, the same idea of forward, same kind of leadership, just small changes. So same usual questions, same answers. Then there's radical reform, more modernity, but different leadership and larger changes. Same questions, different answers. But then there's beyond reform, where it's acknowledged that more modernity is not an option, given the violence required to keep modernity in place in the limits of the planet. So here there are different questions and different answers. We have a report called Moving with Storms that talks about the lessons learned in this material, like concrete experiment. And one of the things that we learned is that inviting people into the process of hospicing is hard. There's more and more people interested right now. And it comes with a lot of anxiety and a lot of grief also for the planet and for everything that's happening. So one of the things that we needed to do as part of the educational inquiry was expand people's capacity to sit with difficult and painful things without relationships falling apart, without people feeling overwhelmed and immobilized, and without people demanding a rescue from the discomfort of this experience. And we developed a set of invitations that really helped people to come to the space and to show up in a different way. And this is what I'm going to conclude my presentation with, by sharing those with you. It's an invitation for 7 steps back and 7 steps forward or aside. And here are the invitation for the 7 steps forward or aside. The first is the invitation to step forward or aside with honesty and courage, to see what you don't want to see. The second is the invitation to step forward or aside with humility, to find strength in openness and vulnerability. Number 3 is about stepping forward or aside with self-reflexivity, so that you can read how you're being read and learn to read the room. Number 4 is stepping forward or aside with self-discipline, to do the work on yourself so that you don't become work for other people. 5 is stepping forward or aside with maturity, to do what is needed rather than only what you want to do. Number 6 is stepping forward or aside with expanding discernment and attention, increasing care in proportion to risk. And number 7 is stepping forward or aside with adaptability, flexibility, stamina, and resilience for the long haul, to be prepared to fall, to fail, to have our plans shattered, to be stretched, to change course, and to find joy in the struggle itself rather than in the imagined prize, promised outcome at the end.
Vanessa Andreotti is currently Dean of the Faculty of Education at the University of Victoria. Her book is Hospicing Modernity, Facing Humanity's Wrongs and the Implications for Social Activism, published in 2021. The selection for radio comes from her presentation July 21st, 2023, posted by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
He could be 30.